35. And it says that the favor or will of the king is to a wise slave, and his anger will be to, he uses the word embarrassed. In other words, he uses the word embarrassed for a foolish slave, because he'll embarrass himself. Okay? Yeah, the will of the king is for an intelligent slave, and his anger will be upon the embarrassed one. Yes, it's in Proverbs chapter 14, verse 35. The question is, who's the king? A regular king, a normal king, okay? That's what we're talking about. I think the verse, the subject of the verse is the slave, not the king, okay? In other words, there are different situations that you have to do actions, okay? Now, what Mishlei is trying to get across is every different angle that you can act intelligently or you can act foolishly. And therefore, he says, even if you're a slave, there is an intelligent way and a foolish way of acting. And if you act the intelligent way, so then the king will be happy with you. If you act the foolish way, so then, of course, the king will be upset with you. In other words, there is a way, in any given situation, there is an intelligent way and a foolish way of acting. What this verse is talking about is even as a slave, you can act, even if you're a slave, there's a way of acting intelligently in relationship to the king, or you can act foolishly in relationship to the king. One will bring out his favor or his will and be happy with you. The other will bring out his anger. The question is that this assumes that the king can discern the difference. No, the answer is that the slave must understand the nature of the king and know how to act correctly in relationship to that particular king. You see, there are righteous kings and unrighteous kings, all different types of kings that you have to relate to. And what the king wants, the slave must know exactly how to react to the king's desires and the king's will and whatever the king wants. So he knows exactly how to deal with the king. The question is that a king could be threatened by an intelligent slave. Well, then he'll have to know how to cover up his intelligence, to act in an intelligent way without bringing it out to that the king should feel subservient. In other words, this verse could be applied. One Earl said to God, which the Rabbeinu Yonah mentioned, that God loves an intelligent person that understands not only that he has to obey God, but how to obey God and understand the reasons why. And also, anybody that's in a subservient situation, like an employee with an employer, you have to know how to act. There's a certain amount of politics. Besides doing the correct thing, there's a certain way of acting that you must know how to deal and to act correctly in any given situation. In other words, you don't know your place. In other words, if you're a situation where you should be subservient and you don't recognize your place, that would be a foolish act, and like the foolish slave. Chapter 15, verse 1. It says, a soft answer removes anger, while an answer that's vicious or harmful will awaken anger. The situation, he says, if you answer softly, means somebody attacked you, the natural response is to react and to attack back. Okay? Now, Mishlei deals with situations where if the situation is obvious. I mean, I think most people know that if somebody is angry with you, you don't react in anger in kind after a while the person has to. I mean, you just can't be angry at them, you see? But the thing is that it is a very, very tough. But most people are angry and they react. And so what the pasuk is saying is an obvious thing that you have to spend time thinking about. In other words, many times there's obvious things and, oh, that's obvious, and you move on. But however, to deal with the emotion, you must review the idea every time. In other words, every time you get angry, you have to review this idea to show that the greater benefit is to act softly even when somebody acts angry, you see? So the thing is that it's an idea that is so obvious that why should King Solomon mention it? The answer is that King Solomon mentions is that you have to review this idea and with your mind see it again and again until your anger is lower. And you don't have that anger. Even when people are angry with you, you do not react with anger. It doesn't matter. Initially, there's a certain level where a person could remove an emotion. But however, initially we're talking about where you might have the emotion, you might be angry, but the reality takes over at a certain point and makes you act correctly despite your emotion. It's not a matter of undoing the anger, it's a matter of it being realistic of the harm that occurs.
In other words, the best thing is when a person attacks, you see, is just to answer the question as if it was asked in a very soft and calm way. Relate to the subject and not to the person's anger or his emotion. But, I mean, you don't have to be subservient to an angry person. I'm just saying you can answer the person, and that's what it says. It says answer softly. What are you answering? The answer is he has a certain complaint, a certain argument. So just listen to the argument and forget about how he gives the argument. You see what I mean? And then answer to the argument without dealing with the anger.
The best way to explain the verse is that if a person said told you some point about you that you have a weakness or something is wrong, then you should be honest. If it's true, then accept it. If it's not true, show them where it is not true, you see? But the only thing is that when a person says it with anger, you should answer him as if he said it in a nice, quiet way. In other words, if a person attacks you with anger, it doesn't mean you should sulk away and pull away and back off. But it means don't answer with anger, but answer what the person is saying, and ignore the tone that he says it. Totally ignore the tone. The question is, maybe you should walk away. If somebody has an attack on you, maybe it's better to walk away and ignore it. It depends. I would have to say it depends. It depends on the situation. But the only thing is, sometimes you have to change. Sometimes, even when a person is angry, you have to change his view of the way he's looking at you, and you have the right to change his view. All you have to do it is say it in a nice way. In other words, when it works and when it doesn't work, I mean, there's always distinction. But I'm just saying that there has to be a certain attitude when a person is angry. There is sometimes the person can't listen to any of it. Sometimes all you got to do is repeat the answer again. And sometimes it takes many, many times, but just repeat it in a soft and nice way, you know what I'm saying? Without getting angry and without getting upset. And just, you know what I mean, try to show the person your point. They refuse to listen. So then, of course, then there's nothing to talk about. We're still chapter 14, verse 35. And it says that the will of the king to a servant who is intelligent. In other words, he is happy, he's accepting of the slave that's intelligent, and his anger is to the one that's embarrassing, meaning that he does stupid things. Okay? It seems like there are no problems. It's a very clear proverb. But the thing is also, some people want to say that the king is God, okay? And they put it this way, that there are people that keep the commandments, just they keep it, but they don't have any knowledge or wisdom or understanding. So he says the God is the close to the person that does the mitzvahs, the commandments, because he sees the advantage and the benefit or the goodness of it, or he sees it because that God commanded him and he's obligated to obey God, but he sees the truth behind it, why he should do it. And God's anger is upon those that keep the mitzvahs that are... that they only do it because they were raised that way or because their society is that way. They do it for that reason. Okay? So, even though the commentary seems to say that they will get a reward in the world to come for just doing the commandments. So he seems to say that. But the verse doesn't seem to point to that. The verse seems to point, if you can interpret it by God, then it seems to point only if you understand the value, then God will relate to you, would accept you. You're accepted. But if you do the commandments just because you were raised that way or you're part of a society, so he says, then you have God's anger. Okay? The question is, what if they're not good explanations? The answer is you can't have an explanation for every commandment, for every idea. But in general, you have the general view that God gave the commandments, and you see that there are answers to certain ones, so then where you don't have it, you understand there are answers, but you just don't have them, that's all. Okay? All right. But chapter 15, verse 1. It says, a soft answer turns away anger, and a sad statement brings out anger. Yeah, etzev is the word, means sad, but it means it's a retort, like a retort that causes sadness. In other words, where you give a sharp answer back. Okay? In other words, by it means by a soft answer, if somebody tells you off, so you should answer softly and not give a sharp retort. Okay? And I think most people know this. I don't think it's something new, but the question is, why is he telling us this? But the answer is that many times King Solomon will write things that are obvious, but it's not obvious to our emotions. And we need, in other words, many times we have proverbs that, yeah, of course it's true, but emotionally we can't live with it. This is a very, very hard emotion to live with. Somebody tells you off, when you answer back, you bring out more anger to the person. The person doesn't see that he's wrong when you tell him off. So if you talk nicely, I mean, it's very hard for him to be angry. But your emotions don't allow you to talk nicely to somebody that just told you off. So you react in the same manner. But it says the long run, you'll just cause more anger. Verse 2 says, the language of the wise enhances wisdom, and the mouth of the fool flows foolishness. So it's saying that the tongue of the wise means that it's a thought out thing, comes from the tongue, which mouth usually doesn't imply that, okay? And also, because of his thought, the way he expresses it, it enhances wisdom. And of course, that will include what we said in the first verse, to the way he says it. Even in the tone and the way he says it, all that would be included in the tongue or language of the wise. But the mouth of the fool, it just comes out from the emotions. It's without thought. So it just keeps flowing what his feelings, what he's feeling at the moment. He just flows whatever at that moment. It just comes out like it's flowing. Okay? Verse 3. In every place is the eyes of God. He sees evil and good. And the question is what is this doing here? You know what I mean? Like, it has nothing to do with anything we're talking about, just out of the blue. Like, suddenly he says, in all places, the eyes of God. I mean, that's a thing about God. What is it doing here in Proverbs? You understand? Like, this is a true fact, and it needs to be analyzed and understood. But I think the main question that we have to ask is, what is it doing here? And the subject. I think the reason why it's mentioned here is because most people don't hold that what they say is really good and evil. So I'm only speaking. I didn't really mean it. You know what I mean? I was only joking. An action is different. Most people hold an action could be good or evil. But however, when you speak, I didn't really mean it. I'm only joking. You know what I mean? Those type of things. We negate that what I say is important. Or even what I think. It's not like, we don't think of that as being good and evil. You see? The subject that we're talking about was going to continue in the subject of speaking. You see? So he comes out, he's saying that speaking is also considered an evil. That's what he's saying. He's bringing out, because most people, in other words, if you would say, if you talk gossip, is it evil? Yeah, you would say it's evil. You don't really feel it. You don't really, a person doesn't really feel it. It's not like if you would punch somebody out, you know? Like, you punch somebody out, then you feel like did something evil. But if you ruin a person's reputation, somehow, I was only speaking. I didn't mean anything by it. You know what I mean? I'm sorry it happened, you know? But it's not, I don't really feel that it's evil. So therefore, he puts emphasis that God sees good and evil. You see, and God is aware of good and evil is even in the tongue, and he has to put strong emphasis on it to make sure you become aware of it over the natural tendency of the human being to feel that speaking is not really anything. It's not an action. You don't consider it an action. The question is if it's the way I'm saying, then it should say that in all places God hears, and he hears good and evil. Why does it say see? Why does it use the metaphor of seeing? I mean, God doesn't see or hear. How he knows is altogether different. But the thing is that that's a good point, and I don't know why. Maybe there are other reasons, but definitely based on the subject, It seems to be the explanation, but I do not know why it uses the term eyes instead of hearing. Maybe just for some reason, whenever you say that God is aware, you say God sees, and they don't use the metaphor of God hears. I wouldn't know. I don't know. I mean, and even in everyday life, when somebody tells you over something, you don't say, I hear, you say, I see. So seeing seems to be sense that is used for understanding, where the mind understands something, you use the word the see. So if God is aware, you use the word see, but it has nothing to do with the subject. The question is thought. We know that people have to have certain ideas about God, which is only ideas, and if you don't have these ideas, that would be wrong. Okay? But the thing is, does it mean the mind also here? I don't know, because the subject seems to be the tongue. So I could only attach it to the subject, and the subject is only tongue, not what's in the mind. So therefore, it could mean also that which is in the mind also, but not based on the subject. So I can't extend it to things that I think is evil. I can only extend it to the tongue, which is the subject of this chapter so far. Verse 4, it says like this. Healing the tongue is a tree of life, and a distortion in it, when you distort the tongue, in other words, what you say, is it breaks the spirit. And the first question is what does it mean to heal the tongue? Two, what is the tree of life? And what does it mean that if you distort it, it breaks the spirit? What do you mean break a spirit? What does that mean? And how does it break a spirit? What, you don't understand. It breaks the spirit. What does that mean? Okay, so they want to say that healing the tongue means to correct the, what we said, there's different things about the tongue before, different mistakes, like you answer back incorrect, like if a person is tough on you, so you answer back tough on him. That's one mistake. Two is you just speak from the emotions or whatever comes into your mind without thinking about it. It just flows out without any thought. Okay? Now the question is, so how would you heal that type of problem? Even though in the verse doesn't seem to tell you how, but I guess we'll have to go to other parts of Proverbs to find the answer. But it's not in the verse, that's for sure. It doesn't tell you how, but I think it's important to discuss it anyway, even though it's not in the verse. The question is, how do you go about healing your tongue? David wants to say like this, that when a person speaks, whatever he speaks is an expression of what's on his mind. Okay? Has to be. So the thing is that... He has to change the way he thinks about life, okay? And therefore, the way you think about life, that is the study of Musar. So therefore, a constant review or constant study of the ideas of Musar will help you think a different way. And once you start thinking a different way, so then you would start speaking differently. In other words, if you think differently, then you would speak differently. Okay? So therefore, it would be the study of Musar, the study of ethics and morals. Okay? Like we're doing here in the Proverbs. And so the question is, what is the tree of life? In the commentaries, there's two explanations. One is the tree itself, and the fruits of the tree. The tree itself means that you will live a long life. In other words, like this. In other words, if you go back to the metaphor, where it's going back to the story of the tree of life, God didn't want the Adam to eat of the tree of life because then he would live forever. Okay? He ate from the tree of knowledge, but then he chased them out, so you shouldn't eat from the tree of life. Okay? So the tree of life means living forever. Living, we wouldn't say forever because we can't live forever, but it means living a longer time. The Ibn Ezra, and I saw it in the Ibn Ezra, I saw it in the Rambam, that they hold that conflict shortens your life. And today, they're coming back to that theory. Okay? For many years, they didn't hold from that, but today they're holding that your emotions definitely affect your life, and therefore conflict. I mean, you could see it easily in these young presidents that came in with nice dark hair and youthful looking with vigor, and then you see a picture of them 4 years or 8 years later, their hair turned gray and their eyes are puffy and their faces are not as youthful looking, like you get old over a very short period. I mean, you can really see it, okay? Also, we know that there are studies of people that that if they were positive about their disease and helped them fight, it brought on, it caused their bodies to fight the disease better. And those people that were depressed would they couldn't fight. I mean, there's all new studies. There's a new study about lower back pain that it says that the pain is not real. It's only caused by the psychological. Well, it's a real physical pain, but the pain, in other words, it seems like if you have tension, so it shortens the oxygen. That's the way I understand it. So therefore, you become knotted and stiff, and therefore you get a backache. So the pain is physical, but however, the cause is by the mind. You understand? So all these things show that the emotions have a powerful effect on your physical life. So he's saying that the if you heal your tongue, meaning you heal your mind and how you think, and that would heal the tongue. In other words, the tongue is like a symptom of the disease of the mind. So that would give you a long life. If you talk about the fruit of the tree of life, it seems like it would give you a different quality of life. So either the pasuk is talking about the quantity of life or the quality of life. Okay? So if you straighten out your conflicts through the study of Musa, so then you will have a good life or a long life. Okay? The second here, but if you don't, if you keep that distortion of the tongue, then your spirit will be broken. I think basically we explained that, in other words, that it would break them from within. Sooner or later it would break them because of their incorrect thinking. It would affect them in different ways. One is it will cause them to make incorrect decisions, which will put them in different types of conflict, which causes stress. And this would cause a tremendous amount of stress. Two, physically you could harm yourself by making incorrect decisions because you're not living correctly. So therefore the way you eat, exercise, all these type of things, the way you make decisions could affect you in an adverse way. And so therefore in all these things, it would shorten your life and take away the quality of life. The question is that the main important thing should be a quality of life. What is the quantity of life? Well, the truth is like this. There are certain people that were destined to die young by their genes. We're not talking about them. Okay, everybody dies. We're not talking about dying in general. What we're talking about is that when your life is shortened, because of your conflicts, that also shows the quality of life. It does both. Really there, it really does both. It's the quantity, when you cut your life short, not because your genes only say you could live a certain amount, but because of the way you made decisions or the conflicts that you didn't straighten out, that you could have straightened out. Not all conflicts could you straighten out, but the ones that you could have. So then it's your own fault. In that case, it becomes your own fault that you don't have the quality of life and you don't have the length of life. I guess in the long run, it's going to have to do the fullness of life because a person can't spend his life just to live long. You understand? That would be a catastrophe. So therefore, it must imply, even in the length of life, it must imply the quality of life. We're in Proverbs chapter 15, verse 3, and it says, in all places are the eyes of God. He sees evil and good. In all places means that all places where humans are going, where there could be good and evil, are the eyes of God, means God knows. God is aware, or God knows. How he knows, that's a different problem. We don't know. That's a different problem. But anyway, he does see. By see, it doesn't mean physically, because God doesn't have eyes. It means he knows or is aware. He sees evil and good, you know, in all places where human beings are. The first question is that it's really obvious. very, I mean, of course, God knows everything. That's a basic principle of Torah. And secondly, why does it belong in Proverbs? I mean, it certainly doesn't belong in Proverbs. Proverbs is a book of ethics and morals, not knowledge of God. Suddenly it comes in with this idea of God. Why is it suddenly come in with this idea of God? Right. Now, we have such a thing called a conscience, okay? And the conscience also looks at things through good and evil. But what is good and what is evil is basically the way you were raised. Either your parents or your society dictates what is good and what is evil, okay? So, the thing is that some people, when they look at God via the way they were raised, some people look at God as a good God, and God will protect me, and God will do all for me, you see? So therefore, if they don't see, in other words, like in other words, God will overlook evil, you know what I mean? That God will overlook evil. Certain people look at God more in the way they were raised, more as a fire and brimstone, that God looks at life from evil and is always trying to get you. You understand? They don't see the goodness. You understand? I mean, there's the two extremes in the conscience, the way people are raised, the way they see God. Okay? And you hear, when people talk, you can hear which way they look at it, but usually it's one or the other. Okay? What the Pasuk is saying is that you must deal with, you must not interpret God based on your conscience or the way you were raised or the way you see God from the way you were raised, but you must look at God in a realistic way. The realistic way, simply, he's aware of everything and he acts on everything. I mean, there's certain rules and regulations when he acts and how he acts. That's not the book of Mishlei. That's a different book in Torah, how God relates to us. Basically, the rest of Torah, most of Torah deals with it. But the thing is that over here it's telling us to deal with our incorrect, where our emotions, which is the book of Mishlei, where our emotions look at life incorrectly. And we make decisions based on the way we look at life. In other words, whether you look at, if you look at God, that God is all good and God overlooks evil, you know what I mean? So then that's one view of life. It's one certain philosophy. If you look at God, that God looks at only the evil, he doesn't do anything good, and God is fire and brimstone, so it's a different philosophy of God. And what we're saying is both are wrong. Both are wrong. God sees everything. Verse 4 says, a healing tongue is a tree of life. And anybody that's distorted, that his tongue is distorted, then he breaks his spirit. He breaks the spirit. Okay? Alright. That's the verse. The first question is, what's a healing tongue? Okay? That's the first question. Okay, the question is, what is the distorted tongue? And the last question, what do you mean you break the spirit? What is a broken spirit? Okay? Now, your first possibility of what is a healing tongue is you know the needs of a person, and you speak to his needs, okay? Now, how is that a tree of life? What is, in other words, whatever a healing tongue is, has to be a tree of life. And that is a possibility of the pasuk. There is another possibility that he's just talking about Musa in general. Musa, or the subject of Mishlei, right? That the subject of Mishlei gives you a life. In other words, the tree of life means that it gives you a way of life, a way of living, so that you have a good life. It's not only life itself, but it's the good life. It does give you a longer life when you're without conflict, that we've spoken about many times, but it also gives you the good life. The tree of life means it's a good life, and therefore the best life that a person could have is a life of Musar. So therefore, where Musar, a healing tongue would be the tongue that gives musa, that would heal people because it would give them a way of life. Okay? Could also be talking about the particular, like Doug wanted to say, that you help people in particular, that would be a healing tongue. Where you help people in particular. Okay. So there's two possibilities. And another possibility is a healing tongue is a person that tells the stories that you could learn lessons, which is musa. In other words, it knows how a storyteller that brings out musa to the public, which would help the public. Therefore, it's a tongue where he's helping the public, and the way to help the public is through stories. So it'd be stories that you could learn lessons from, while a distorted tongue would be the opposite, where you tell stories that are hurtful and harmful to people, like Lashon Hara or the such. Okay? Very good. The thing is that what it's talking about, the Selef, is where he tells advice or he tells ideas that are not based on ideas, but it's based on his own feelings, on his own personal view of life, on his own distorted view of life. So that breaks the spirit, because people make decisions the way they look at life and the way they act upon life based on this thing. So that will actually break them, because they're going to do incorrect acts and do things that are harmful to themselves, because it's an incorrect philosophy. The next point I'd like to make is in Numbers, in Chumash, okay, Bamidbar. And it's chapter 11, verse 4 and 5, okay? And it says the rabble. Rabble was those that were, comes from the word added. They were added to the nation of Israel. Rashi will tell us that that was the Arab rabble, the Egyptians that came along, that saw the truth, and they came along. The rabble that was among them cultivated a craving, and the children of Israel also turned. In other words, they started it, and once they started it, they got involved, the Israelites. In other words, if they weren't there, it seems like the Israelites would have never done this. But they affected the Israelites. And they wept and said, "Who will feed us meat?" And then it says in verse 5, "Remember the fish that we would eat in Egypt free of charge." And then it goes on to all different types, cucumbers and melons and leeks and onions and garlic. It seems like they had a good life in Egypt. Okay? And they said that here we're not getting anything. All right. So Rashi says, first of all, didn't they have meat? They had meat. Because it says that what went with Israel when Israel left Egypt was the Erev Rav, and they got sheep and cattle. Okay? So they took along sheep and cattle, so they had with them. Now what if you can ask and say, well, maybe they ate them up at this point. They were all consumed. They didn't have any. You can't say that, because when we entered the land of Israel, it says that the sheep of the tribe of Reuven and Gad, these were shepherds, these two and a half tribes were shepherds, they had abundant livestock. They had a tremendous amount of livestock. So he says, why do they complain about lack of meat? He says, because they were looking to have a fight with God. They were looking for an argument. Sometimes people are looking for an argument. They have to find an argument. So they have the crazy argument. In other words, it wasn't a real complaint. Sometimes if you have a real complaint, so God says, okay, it's a real complaint. You're missing something. You need something. Fine. But here, Rashi is trying to show that it was a complaint not based on reality. So it's people looking for a fight. Okay? Now the question is, so what's bothering them? If they're looking for a fight, something has to be bothering them. What's bothering them? So he says, we want what we had in Egypt, that we had we had free of charge. We had food free of charge in Egypt. We didn't have to do anything for it. So he says, if you're going to say that the Egyptians gave them fish for free of charge, It says already that they didn't even give him straw to work with. You mean they're not going to give him straw, but they're going to give him fish and cucumbers and all a big meal? You know what I mean? A big barbecue that they're going to make for them. I mean, that's just not going to happen. Okay? So he says, what does it mean it was free of charge? So Rashi says, free from obligation to perform the commandments of the Torah. This is what's bothering them. That they had to do all the commandments of the Torah, and this was bothering them. Okay? So, and because they didn't want to do the commandments of the Torah, so therefore they had a whole pretext. They're very upset about this, and they made a whole pretext to start a fight. Okay? Okay, now the question is, what is the problem with keeping Torah? I mean, it's not only them. I mean, even in modern times, there's a lot of people that don't want to keep Torah. Okay? They don't want the responsibility for Torah. So the question is, what is the problem with Torah that people can't, that it's hard for them to keep? The thing is that there are two types of responsibilities. There are responsibilities that you're very aware of. Like a person has to get a job, has to work. If he doesn't work, he can't make a living, can't support his family. So that's a very obvious responsibility. You understand? But then there are responsibilities that are good for the person and beneficial to the person that he doesn't see, like justice. Sometimes a person doesn't see. You have a responsibility to do justice, but they don't see the benefit. That's what Cal was saying. You understand? Or kindness. You don't see the benefit in it. You don't see the true benefit in it. You just see that certain responsibility, like I'm a nice person, so therefore I do kind deeds. You see? Same thing with the commandments of the Torah. You could do it because the conscience tells me that it's the right thing to do. Or I could see the benefit, how it benefits my life. You see? It seems like... Now, the thing is, now you have to understand, here we're talking about a nation that was on Mount Sinai. You understand? I mean, they couldn't have known it more than anybody else. You see? But you can't... It's an amazing thing. You cannot get away from your personality. You could see truth and you could see reality, but that doesn't mean you could change your life around just by seeing it. There's a part of you, the personality part, that still relates to the realistic information in a very different way. It is possible that there are people that look both ways when they cross the street only because they're afraid of their mommy or their daddy. And they're adults. Could be that they've never outgrown that part of them, you see. Even though it's very obvious, it's a reality that's with your five senses. So you could relate to reality in a realistic way, or you could relate to reality according to your basic emotions, according to your personality, the way you relate to the physical world, you see. Now, the nation of Israel was on Mount Sinai. I mean, they heard God's voice. They knew God. There was no question about it. They were on the highest level that the nation could be at any time when they were on Mount Sinai. But then when they came down from that level, you see, they're still their personality. You can't just let your personality go there. Well, I know reality. That's enough. That's only one step. There's a second step. I must look at how I relate to that reality. And usually you relate to a reality based on your old childish view of life, you see. And therefore an investigation of how the emotions look at life is also a necessary thing. And to undo that, so that you could start operating when you see reality, that you could actually live by that reality. In other words, You have a certain pattern in which you relate to life, and even when you know reality, you can relate to it with those old patterns. Therefore, you must know the patterns of your life and to start changing the patterns of your life so that you can relate to reality. That's what the verses say. There are times in life when you see a reality, and the reality is enough that are very, very attached. They're kept in tow by strong desires, by fears. You understand? They're kept in place with powerful, powerful resistances against anything that is different. And therefore, you must overcome these resistances and deal with the resistance that's stopping you from living and that life of truth that you live in. You see? So there's certain truths that the resistance is not that strong. So you see the truth and you're able to change. There's certain times you can see the truth and it's so obvious, but yet you can't change. Okay? The first step that you have to do is to know the truth. What does reality dictate? And then to see where your emotions take you. If your emotions take you away from reality, so those are the emotions that you have to deal with. But first you have to know what is reality. And then you see if you are living within line with that reality or not. If you're not living in line with that reality, then you must deal with that part of you where you see that the rationale, that the reality didn't change your personality. So therefore you have to deal directly with the personality. Right. A foolish person despises his father's discipline, but he who harbors... No, the English is not that great. Let me try it again. Okay. A fool despises the musa of his father, and he who guards reproof or tachacha is wise. Yarim is there's different types of wise. Yarim is it uses the same term by the snake, right? That he was orum, he was trickery, like he knows all the tricks. Clever, right? Clever is the best word. Clever, that's the best word. The word avil is usually that he's superficial. Okay. Usually a superficial type, there's certain fools that go in depth. They really think deeply. But, I mean, their emotions affect the way they think. A vil is usually a superficial type of thought. Doesn't go into much depth. Okay? And he despises the mussar of his father. And he who guards tochacha will become clever. So the first question is, why didn't it just say he despises Musa? Why are you a Musa of the father? Right? Okay, that's the first question. But the question is, it should say he knows Tochacha, he accepts Tochacha. What is guarding? Why? What does it mean, guarding Tochacha? The question is, why does it say clever? Well, clever is a deeper type of... a deeper type of wisdom. It's in other words, by the snake he was very manipulative, and the question is that maybe manipulative is a bad thing. The answer is there's only one thing that's absolutely wrong: serving idolatry. That's always wrong. But in other words, let's say for instance, killing. Sometimes it's killing. Sometimes it's murder. If I beat you over the head, it depends. If you're a murderer and I'm trying to protect somebody from being murdered, so then it's a good thing. If I'm a murderer, then it's a bad thing. There isn't an act that is absolutely wrong. You understand? Every act depends on the situation and the motive, so the act becomes correct. Right? So the thing is, there's nothing wrong in being manipulative if you're manipulative for a good purpose. Let's say you fool a person into because it's for his own benefit. There's a Gemara that says that somebody asked Hillel to convert him on the condition that he becomes a Kohen Gadol, a high priest, which is impossible. You have to be born a Kohen before you can become a high priest. And Hillel said yes. Then later when he started learning and he found out the halacha, he says, how come you faked me out? He says, wasn't it worth it? You understand that if you have Torah and the ideas of Torah, and so it wasn't worth it? So you see that being manipulative is not bad inherently. Depends how you use it. What does the word guard in general mean? The word guard. In other words, you want to make sure you don't lose it. Right? Guarding, the word guard implies that you don't want to lose something. Okay? So therefore, in other words, like this. Let's say, for instance, a person studies for a test. Now, most kids, I ask, how long do they remember the information after the test? Now, depending on the memory, it could be 2-3 days. And then usually the information is lost, unless it is something that you're going to use. Like if you learn the numbers table, how to add. So you use that in everyday life, so you won't forget it, okay? But the thing is, so we're not talking about just knowing it. We're talking about not losing it, okay? So guarding means that I am doing an activity which I make sure that I won't lose it, okay? Now the question is, what would a person have to do to make sure he doesn't lose it? Now, if you tell me you have to review it, well, if you ever stop reviewing it, you're going to forget it. I mean, unless you have a rare people, you know, they have a photographic memory. But otherwise, most people, after a while, you know, it depends how much you review it. After a while, you forget it. Now, you can't, you know what I mean? How much could you review? You know what I mean? You have to move on, you know what I mean? So the thing is, review is a good thing, it's an important thing, but I don't think review is guarding. In other words, that will help you not lose it. In other words, there must be something that you will not lose it. So Musar, or Tochacha, is a way of thinking and acting about life. So once you start thinking that way, then you will not lose it. Okay? So therefore, you must reach a level where the system of Musa Tafaha becomes naturally a way of thinking, that's the way you think. In other words, let's say, like, for instance, most times Musa, the basics of Musa is that you should always see the consequences of your act. So every time you have to do an act, immediately your mind goes to all the possibilities of what could be the result of this act. It naturally goes there. Most people, it doesn't go there. Most people, it goes to the what pleasure I'm going to have in some fantasy or some daydream or something, some enjoyment, the result, some greatness or something I'm going to get out of it. The Baal Musa, the person that really his nature is to think, so he's naturally going to think of, if I do this act, what are the consequences of this act? Well, if I don't do a certain act, what are the consequences of that act? You see what I mean? So the thing is, I think Shomer means where the person works on it until it becomes a second nature and he thinks that way. Okay, the question is that experientially, somebody asked the question that when he looks back only when he was hit very emotionally, does he remember the rebuke and the rebuke affects him, and not when he got logic. The logics did not help him much, but somehow he was affected emotionally, and when he was affected emotionally, that rebuke helped him. That is the question, that it doesn't seem that logic works. Okay? I think the problem is, you know, there were most tyrants understand the value of thought and the power of thought. Why? Because they burn books. You understand? They realize. But most people don't realize the power of knowledge. Right? So people underestimate the power of thought. Now, I'll give you an example that I've given many, many times. And that is, it was General Patton. He says how to become a general. He says you should study every battle that you could get your hands on. Study the strategy of both generals. Check the terrain, with the terrain that they had, because that would affect the strategy. Find out the weather, because the weather could affect have effects on the strategy. He says, and to think it through from every angle. Okay. Then listen to what he says. He says not to remember this or that battle. Says, but when you are creating a battle plan, then those battles start working, and you start thinking that way. You understand? That's exactly what we're saying about Nisr. Okay? There are people like psychiatrists. They just talk with the person. I mean, there's certain types of psychology and psychiatry that they just talk to the person and help the person understand, and there's a change in the person, okay? The same thing here. There's a certain way of thinking, and as you learn Musa, you start again and again and again. In other words, really the whole book of Mishlei is built on one principle, or maybe two principles. One principle is to see the consequences of your act, and then the second principle will be to evaluate the act that you do now versus the consequence, whether it's worth it or not. Okay? That's basically the whole book. See, King Solomon, I mean, this is in Pirkei Avos. King Solomon didn't have to write a book. You understand? He wrote a book just on example and different angles again and again and again and again. These same, every verse, if you listen to the verses, every verse has this principle, these two principles, basically. Okay? The two principles are that I evaluate the consequences of my actions, I figure out the consequences of my actions, then I evaluate my action now, whether it's worth the consequence. Okay? So, sometimes it is, sometimes it's not, yeah. Has to be a real evaluation, and you can't let your emotion affect your thinking. If you learn to think this way, and you see the value of thinking this way, this will be, in other words, even if it's in situations where nobody spoke to you, or a totally new situation comes up, if your mind is trained this way, so then you will think this way and you will make decisions based on the training of King Solomon. In other words, King Solomon had a method of thinking and he's reviewing it for the beginner hundreds and thousands of times so that you will be able to think, you become creative in such a way that you'll be able to think of in new situations or create new categories that he doesn't have. But you can't create all the categories that exist in every possible situation. But he wrote it enough is written here, that you will be able by reviewing it again and again to start thinking this way, so that once you start thinking this way, you'll create new categories. Categories that he didn't write about. You see? But you learned how to think that way. The method of emotions, I only know that one act that emotionally I was trained to do, right? But I don't even know if that act was good or bad. Let's say, for instance, somebody gave me rebuke, and it's really bad advice.
then it becomes part of me because of my emotion. But since I didn't think it through, it might be bad advice. It's not always good. Even good intentions, and a person thinks it's good, it's not always good. So it might not be good. So I have to think through to be able to make sure it's good. Then I need training how to think through every single idea that it becomes second nature to me. You see? It's a way of thinking that any situation that comes about, you'll be prepared to be able to deal with it, to work it out. Now the question is, that is all that's fit into the pasuk. It fits into the pasuk shomer of guarding. Guarding means, how could you guard? Guard means that you should not lose it, right? How will you not lose it? Is it not to remember this or that pasuk, not to remember this or that idea that you get from the pasuk, but that it becomes part of you so that after a while you start thinking this way. Once you start thinking this way, then you're a different person. That's how it fits into the pasuk, fits into the word shomer. Now, of course, if you're going to train yourself in this way, you're going to become clever or a chacham. We didn't define the difference between a chacham and a orum, orim. We didn't define the difference. But the fact is, it's a type of chacham. It's a type of wise person. Okay? So we're saying that that by nature you must be wise because you must be able to think through in everyday life how to make correct decisions and not follow your emotions, but follow the correct ideas and not to follow your emotions. That is a wise person. A wise person, according to King Solomon, is a person who could make rational decisions despite his emotions. It's not the abstract thinker. You could be an abstract thinker and they'll call you a jerk. King Solomon will call you a jerk. I mean, the way you act. I mean, the books about these great thinkers and great creative mathematicians and physicists, and they live crazy lives and they make crazy decisions in their lives. He would call them foolish, King Solomon, you see? But you might not be an abstract thinker, but you'll be a chacham. A chacham is a person who's able to make decisions with his mind when his emotions are awakened. He has strong, powerful emotions. The best example is Yosef when he was seduced by Potiphar's wife and he didn't give in and he walked away. Okay? It wasn't an easy decision, but as though his emotions was awakened and he still followed the rationale at that very moment. When the passion is at the highest level. That's why they call him Yosef HaTzadik. That is a tzadik. You see? That is a chacham or a tzadik. The Rabbah says that the Neville is a fool because if he doesn't have Musar, he can't have wisdom. He can't have the sciences. And the truth is, we have many scientists that acted stupidly, but they were very creative in their science. And they were, according to King Solomon, they'd be called fools. The way they lived their personal life, they could be called fools. Okay? The way they make decisions. And the Ralbach says you can't have chachma, meaning you can't have wisdom, that you must have musa or tachacha before you can have wisdom. Before you can have the sciences. And the question is, that seems not to be true based on the facts that we have. Seems not to be a true statement. The word chachma is sometimes used as a chachma in the sense of mishlei. Like that he makes decisions despite his emotions. He still makes logical decisions. And then Chachma also stands for the sciences. So the Rabbah is saying you cannot have the sciences. You can't. They say that the profession that has the most humility in their ranks is astronomers. Okay? Why is that? Because, in other words, if you think the closest star is 4 light years away,
A light year is someplace between 5 and 6 trillion miles. So 4 light years, let's say 5 times 4, is 20 trillion miles. That's the closest star. Do you have the vaguest idea what it means, a trillion miles? Get about 20 trillion. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, the vastness? I mean, it's a number, and yeah, I know it's vast, but it's not like it's going to affect me emotionally, okay? But let's say I would study astronomy. That's my profession. I study it 8 hours a day. And not only do I study about the two suns, the sun, the star that is closest to our sun, but we talk about our galaxy. And then when we start talking in hundreds of light years, and then you talk about galaxies and the space between galaxies and the infinite amount of galaxies, and you're talking 8 hours a day where you go over and over and over, suddenly it affects you how vast, emotionally, it affects you how vast the universe is. And when you recognize the vastness of the universe, you suddenly say, you know, what could be so important about my life? What could be important? Well, what could I accomplish in this vastness, when you see the vastness of the universe? You know what I mean? Like, I'm like a speck of dust. That's it, compared to the whole universe. Not even. You know what I mean? So, the thing is my knowledge affects me personally. It affects the way I live. There are people that have tremendous amount of knowledge and tremendous amount of creativity, but it doesn't affect their life. The ideas don't affect their life. And so therefore, it would be equal to a donkey carrying books. I mean, they have knowledge in their head, you know what I mean? But it's not them. It's outside of them. Like a donkey carrying books. The books is not the donkey. The donkey is not a thinker. He has books. You see? And the same thing, these people have knowledge. And they could walk rings around us. I mean, we're talking about some of the greatest geniuses. They could walk rings around us insofar as knowledge is concerned. But it doesn't affect them. It is not them. Them means it affects them emotionally. It affects their personality. It changes their personality. It does something to them. Like we were talking about guard, where a person with thoughts that he gets from Mishlei become so real that he makes decisions despite his emotions. You understand? Mishlei is the training ground. When you start making decisions in your everyday life, and there could be nothing more important than that, that's going to affect your life, when you do it correctly, you start seeing that ideas affect who you are, how you think, how you make decisions. So then when you study other sciences, suddenly the other sciences, when you see the sciences, they affect you in a certain way emotionally, because you're open to it, you train. In other words, in the world, the scientist is a person that creates new mathematical principle, new principle in physics. You understand? That's not in Torah. Torah, a scientist is a person where the ideas, whether it's Torah, where it comes directly from Torah, whether it comes from the sciences, he's affected by truth and reality, no matter where it comes from. He's affected by these truths, and these truths affect who he is. And he's constantly, his learning is a constant development of the human being, not just getting ideas. It's not just getting ideas, you know, competition, honor, you know what I mean? It's not that. Suddenly he sees the real value is that it changes, knowledge affects who you are, how you make decisions, how you think about life, how you view yourself. All this, the knowledge affects who you are. That's what knowledge is. That's why this. If a person doesn't learn Musa, he really chachmasa yes chach. He might be a genius and is able to walk rings around you, but it's no different than a donkey carrying books. It's outside of him. It's not really him. It's an outside thing. It's not something so real that it affects him. That's what the Rabbah says. Without Musa, there's no science, because he won't learn how to get there. There are people, I mean, that study sciences and it does affect them. Like we said, the astronomers, they are affected by this and they have a high level of humility. But how much more so? I mean, so then they really have it. But how much more so if you sit down to study Musa, where you train, where the whole training is that ideas are real. Ideas are the way you make decisions is the way you think, you see. That's a different type of person. That is what the Rabbah is saying. He has science. The other person, according to the Rabbah, doesn't even have science. Now, just a quick review about the tachacha that affects you emotionally. Okay, first of all, the tachacha that affects you emotionally is only in a particular area. It's that area where they gave you, where they corrected a certain action. So they corrected that action. Let's say your parents corrected that action and now you look both ways when you cross the street. Okay? So that's it. So you look both ways when you cross the street. That's it. But it doesn't help you in any other area where your parents are not going to be there. You understand? Only in the areas that they spoke to you about. Two is sometimes people, even intentionally, everybody is not perfect. And parents, with the best intentions, give you bad advice sometimes. Okay? You can never correct it because it becomes a part of you. So if you're going to get it through rebuke, you understand, through the emotional rebuke, so then once you have a bad training, then that's it. It becomes part of you. And not only that, it's worse than that. Not only does it become part of you, but you think it is correct. And you're going to train your children with that, too. Goes on and on, the mistake. Perpetuates. You see? Well, if you start learning Musa, and you reevaluate everything you learned and all your actions and everything you did, you go back and think it through, you see? So then you'll be able to correct it. And even in the correct ways, you'll understand why it's correct. Not only that it is correct, but you'll understand why it's correct. But if it's only Musa, you don't know why it's correct. You just, it's correct because my parents said so. Right? So there's no chachma at all, and the benefits are very, very small. Very small. Right. Okay, chapter 15, verse 6. It says, the house of the righteous is extremely secure. And now the word tvuas has two translations. It could either mean the coming of the wicked, it is ripped out, or with the prophets of the wicked, it is ripped out. Okay? I'd like to take prophets first, okay? Alright, we'll start it that way. So once again, the house of the righteous is extremely secure, but with the prophets of the wicked, it is ripped, it is uprooted. There are two contradictions. One contradiction is that if it's secure, how could it be uprooted? And two, if the man is a tzaddik, then where's the prophets of the wicked? The Rabbeinu Yonah gives an example of what it means, the prophets of the wicked. He says there's a story in the Talmud that says there was an extremely wealthy man, and he gave charity. But the only thing is, he did not give enough charity for how wealthy he was. You see? For his wealth, he should have been giving more charity. And so therefore, he lost all his wealth. His daughter, I don't know if it was in his lifetime,
But it says his daughter was extremely poor. She used to make a living by following the camels of the Arabs and separating the dung, the food and the dung that came out. That was the way she had to make a living. This was an extremely wealthy man. And he lost everything. So that's what it means. That's the story. Okay? All right, so the question is, does that help us, and how can we explain the pasuk? So the question is, in what way is the house of the righteous vulnerable? In other words, it seems like the house of the righteous is vulnerable, and the question is, in what way is it vulnerable? Now, there is a saying that a chain is as strong as its weakest link, okay? Very few people are perfect, you see. So the thing is that, see, most people try to find what they are good at and feel good about themselves. In fact, that's a big thing in the United States, to compliment people and build their ego, to help their ego out. In Judaism, you don't have to look at the what you're successful at. You have to look at what's going to bring you down. So you have to have a strong enough ego to look at your weaknesses and take care of your weaknesses. Because human beings, even though they are righteous, they really are righteous, but they have weaknesses. And you are as strong as your weakest link, as your weakest area. So therefore, I'm saying that the person is still a tzaddik. I mean, he is righteous. But in certain areas, he acts like a rasha. Okay? He has certain weaknesses. You understand, and there's emotions that bring him down in that area. So the pasuk is telling us to be very careful of that quality. In other words, again, I mean, a chain is as strong as its weakest link, and a human being is also as strong as its weakest link, meaning where he makes mistakes. Okay, emotions that cause him to make mistakes is going to bring him down. So therefore, the pasuk is saying you should be careful. Like, for instance, here we're talking about a person that gave charity. He wasn't a wicked person, like he wasn't stingy. He gave money. He gave a lot of money. But it wasn't to the amount that how much he was worth. He should have given more based on how much he had. So there was a part of him that held back, you see. So therefore, that part of him affected him. You understand? So the same thing in all areas, wherever there is a weakness, that is the area that you have to work on. But you have to have a strong ego to be able to do that. If you have a weak ego and you can't look at your weaknesses, then you could be in trouble, and you won't be able to correct yourself. In other words, you could be righteous and still do certain wicked acts. That is unjust. But as a whole, you're a righteous person. But you have weaknesses, and that's the area that you're going to fail. That's going to bring you down. Okay? And that answers another question. The question is, Doug asked before, that in everyday life we see people that are righteous, that they're not, the house is not so secure. Okay? The answer is that there's one or two reasons why it's not secure. Sometimes there's things outside the realm of your control. It's not in your control. An earthquake happens. It's not in your control. Okay? Well, the book of Mishlei is talking about security insofar as you have the ability to control it. But the other thing is not in control is if you have a weakness, that weakness can bring you down. That weakness could totally wipe you out, could totally destroy you. We also find by the story of Joshua, we sent two spies into Jericho, and they were staying at the Rahab's house. And the king sent the messengers and says, "We heard that there's spies of Israel that came to your house." And so she says, yes, they came to my house, but they already left. Go chase after them. But anyway, one of the commentaries says that if they found out that there were spies in her house, then they must have made some mistake.
And the question is, what is the mistake that they made? They didn't follow all the rules of spying. In fact, in those, there are two verses there about them, about the spies. All the commentaries tell all the rules of spying based on different words and Chazal, every rule of spying. I went through the whole area of spying, all the qualities you need to be a spy. But the thing is, one mistake, the commentary even says, if they were found out, then there had to have been a mistake. Now, once again, we're talking about one person that is righteous, but he has certain emotions that make him make incorrect decisions. You see? That way he's wicked. Okay? So therefore, based on that weakness, he will fail. It's not how the first person became the second person. Every human being is born with weaknesses, with emotions, that they look at life through emotions. Then they become righteous. But as they become righteous, as they think through and start developing, there's still weaknesses. And those weaknesses can bring them down. His righteousness will help him make success, but his weaknesses, which he didn't undo, the emotions which he didn't undo, could still make him fail. That's what the pasuk is saying. The question is what drives a person to be righteous? This is a side point from the pasuk. Okay? The thing is, when a person starts out, so many times he becomes righteous for what we call lo lishma. Lo lishma means the incorrect motive. And it could be because, like you said, it makes him feel good, or he has religious emotions, or whatever. His family wants him, and he wants to follow his family. So he wants to be righteous for these reasons. But the philosophical reason why a person should be righteous is because of this pasuk. And that is, a person will be successful if he doesn't make mistakes. It's only mistakes that bring you down, so that you have to undo your mistakes. So therefore, what you have to see is what your mistake is, then figure out what emotion caused you to think that way, and then deal with that emotion. Now, when you start out, you might find a dozen emotions that you have causing you to do, so you have to choose which one to work on. Sometimes you might, because you're new at it, you might want to start with an easy one, just to see how it works. Or if you're ready for it, you take a difficult one. But you got to start dealing with the emotions. And slowly but surely, not making mistakes in your thinking process. So therefore, a person wants to be righteous because he wants to be successful. The best he finds from Mishlei, that the best way of being successful is through chachma, through wisdom. So therefore he tries to search for wisdom. But he also finds that the emotions make him make mistakes in his thinking process, so therefore he has to undo the emotions that make him make mistakes. Or to neutralize them, even if he can't get rid of them, he should be able to neutralize it, that he shouldn't affect his decision-making process. Just one second. In other words, success is defined by this verse, that the house of the righteous is extremely secure. In other words, you become secure in the physical world. I mean, that is what you mean by success. You're secure, you raise your children securely, and children have a sense of justice, and other things that you inculcated the right thing in them. That is success. Okay, verse 7, it says, the lips of the wise spread knowledge, and the heart of the fool is not so. Now, once again, the lips of the wise spread knowledge, and the heart of the fool is not so. Right, the question is why does it have the lips of the wise and the heart of the fool? Why that difference? And usually in most verses it tells what the consequence is. Here it just says Lochain, it's not so. That the heart of the fool is not so. Well, what does that mean? So the basic question is that the first half of the verse doesn't seem to have anything to do with the second half. That's the basic question. So Chaim wants to say is that the lips of the wise will spread knowledge, while the heart of the fool is not so, will not spread knowledge. Okay? So you have to understand, just like to clarify, most sukkim in Mishle is that you have a very clear dichotomy between the righteous and the wicked, and the wise and the fool. But there's some sukkim, like the last pasuk and this pasuk also, that there could be a wise person that has a deficiency. So we're talking about a person that does not spread knowledge. In other words, he has the knowledge and he doesn't spread it. That's all. In other words, he's a wise person. He lives according to knowledge. He's guided by knowledge, but he doesn't spread it. Okay? That, in that sense, we call him a fool. Okay? In the sense that he doesn't spread it. Okay? Now the question is, why doesn't he spread it? What stops him? In other words, we're talking, it's very clear now how the two sides are equal. One side, I mean, which you said very clearly, that both sides have knowledge. They both have wisdom. They both live a righteous life. The only difference is one teaches and one doesn't teach. When the person that doesn't teach is called a fool, okay? So the question is, why doesn't he teach? One possibility is he doesn't want to. He'd rather just sit by himself and learn and develop himself, and he doesn't want to help, so therefore he would be considered a fool. Okay? More than a fool, he'd be considered wicked. Okay, fine. But there is another possibility. In other words, there could be many different reasons why he doesn't want to share it. Could be he doesn't want to give other PSCs a certain power in it. He doesn't want to share that power with others. He wants to be considered the wise person, so he doesn't want to help you become wise. He's in a rush for his own knowledge, so he doesn't want to take the time to break it down for you. He's too busy getting ahead, and he doesn't want to give it up. There could be many different reasons why he doesn't want to give it over. But the question is, could there be a totally different reason why he doesn't give it over? I want to say the other possibility is that he doesn't have the ability to teach. He doesn't know how to break it down to teach. He doesn't know how to teach. If you don't know how to teach and you have the wisdom, that is, in other words, you're lacking in wisdom. If you don't know how to teach when you have the wisdom, that means you are lacking in wisdom. And where you are lacking in wisdom, you're considered a fool. I don't know which one the verse is talking about, that he doesn't want to. That would really be considered a wicked altogether, but definitely a fool. But the thing is, it is possible that the pasuk is talking about he doesn't teach. Well, it says lochain, he's not so, that he doesn't teach. It could be because he doesn't have the wisdom of how to give it over. You understand? If you don't know how to give over, then you really shouldn't teach. That is wise of him not to teach. But he is a fool in the sense that he doesn't have the knowledge, which is also part of wisdom, on the rules and laws and how to become a teacher. In other words, again, there could be people that don't want to teach. There could be many, many reasons. He wants to live by himself. He wants to develop himself. He doesn't want you to gain knowledge. Wants to be smarter than you. I mean, it could be many, many motives, but they're all one category. He does not want to teach. That's one stage. That's one type. But there's another type, I don't know how to teach. So which one the pasuk is talking about, I don't know which one, but they both could fit into the pasuk. In other words, another case is the person that doesn't know that he is wise, doesn't feel he can teach because he's not wise, so that person is a fool. That would be a third category, because that person is a fool because he doesn't, I mean, he's wise and he doesn't know he's wise. That's a foolish person. He doesn't know himself. That's foolish. Now, the question is, do you have an obligation to teach? Whether you have an obligation to teach or not, that's a separate matter that you have to stop and think what your responsibilities are. You understand that to whom your responsibility is. But however, a person should know, he should be able to teach, he should have that wisdom, and he should not avoid teaching because of selfish reasons, but it's because it makes sense that this is a situation that I should not teach. What if it's not, in other words, I have a good reason for not teaching. But if there's no good reason for not teaching, then I should teach. I should help others. It doesn't have to be formal teaching either. It could be just talking with people and telling over ideas. When you talk with people, it could be on an informal basis. I mean, what form it takes, but if you don't teach, it should not be